Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, November 4th, 2021. County to discuss redistricting county commissioner precincts. Presidio County. Presidio County Commissioner's Court will convene at 9 a.m. on Monday, November 8th, at the courthouse in Marfa to consider a proposal for redistricting the county, potentially shifting the boundaries of the four precincts. The county has contracted with the law firm Allison Bass and McGee, and on Monday, Stan Reed, an associate attorney at the firm, will visit with Presidio County Commissioner's Court to discuss redistricting the current four county precincts. After the Monday meeting, the court plans to hold a hearing on the potential redistricting proposal within a week's time. Concerns about redistricting were raised by County Attorney Rod Ponton after the 2020 census results were returned late, due in part to the pandemic. Previous reporting on last year's census by the Big Bend Sentinel showed a population decrease in southern Presidio County of 25%, a figure that local officials disputed. People on the border just don't get counted for a number of reasons, said Presidio City Administrator Brad Newton at Monday night's Presidio City Council meeting. Newton, Ponton, and other advocates for the City of Presidio redistricting will address the population discrepancies between the two halves of the vast border county. At Monday's meeting, Newton estimated the actual number of southern Presidio County residents at 5,400, nearly double the census numbers for North County, which includes Marfa, Candelaria, and Ruidosa. The people of Presidio need a voice, Ponton said. If redistricting takes place at the rapid pace some hope, the revised districts could impact the ballot, where Presidio Commissioner Eloy Aranda and Marfa Commissioner Buddy Knight's seats are up for election this coming spring. Despite resistance from Representative Gonzalez and Border Patrol Union, DHS works to comply with President Biden's vaccine mandate. Tri-County. President Biden recently announced a sweeping coronavirus vaccine mandate for all federal employees in an executive order released September 9th, requiring full vaccination of federal workers by a November 22nd deadline. The order states the nationwide public health emergency remains in effect, and in keeping with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommendations, the most effective way to prevent against COVID-19 and the highly contagious Delta variant is to get vaccinated. Agencies are required to implement a program to require COVID-19 vaccinations, with few exceptions, according to the order. Department of Homeland Security spokespersons stated they are actively working to comply with President Biden's order. An online system has been developed in order for personnel to report their vaccination status. Employees must notify the agency of their status or request reasonable accommodation, including a religious or medical exemption, by November 9th. Employees who choose to remain unvaccinated for COVID-19 and have not received or have a pending request for a legally required exemption will be subject to discipline up to and including removal from federal service, DHS spokespeople said. Within the employee resources provided by DHS to its workers, including those in FEMA, Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and more, the department explains the timeline that employees must meet in order to be in compliance. The deadline to get in compliance is nearer than it seems, since a requirement of full vaccination by November 22nd means employees must have their second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or first shot of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine, by next Thursday, November 8th. To reach full vaccination, employees needed to begin their Pfizer doses by October 18th, or their Moderna doses by October 11th. The National Border Patrol Council, a union that represents Border Patrol employees across the U.S., including some members in the Big Bend sector, said in late September, "From the moment the EO, executive order, was issued, the National Border Patrol Council, NBPC, instructed its seven attorneys to drop all other matters to study the issue and develop strategies to attack the EO. After spending several days reviewing all pertinent laws to include all relevant case law, our attorneys determined the EO was legal and that there was no viable avenue of challenge," the NBPC, a labor union for Border Patrol agents, said in a statement released to its members in September. Big Bend Sector Public Affairs Officer for the CBP, Greg Davis, stated via email that the agency believes vaccination rates to be higher than officially reported, citing DHS personnel's focus on field work rather than desk work, and the previous policy of voluntary reporting as possible reasons for underreporting. They said they expect reported vaccination rates to go up in the coming weeks. Davis declined to comment on how the mandate could affect the sector more broadly should vaccine mandates cause vacancies to occur. Local Congressman Tony Gonzalez, TX23, led public opposition against the vaccine mandate, specifically for Customs and Border Protection agents, in a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on October 27th. A press release from Gonzalez's office stated the average hiring process for Border Patrol agents can last over 400 days, followed by 20-plus weeks of training at the Border Patrol Academy. With recruitment rates already at an all-time low, the letter speculated whether the agency would be able to fill vacancies expeditiously. "Our men and women in the Border Patrol have worked tirelessly to manage the crisis at our southern border," said the letter. "This year especially, they have been subject to extraordinary amounts of mental and physical stress. With morale at an all-time low, this mandate will serve as a last straw for agents who can easily leave the agency for other law enforcement organizations at the state and local level, or retire." Local voters approve horse race betting initiatives, alcohol sales in special election, by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. Texas voters weighed in on a slate of statewide constitutional amendments in the November 2nd special election, and Presidio County decided whether or not to legalize two types of horse betting. Presidio County voters passed two referendums legalizing pari-mutuel and simulcast betting in the area. This decision opens the door for a horse racetrack to be established in Presidio if it can first receive approval from the Texas Racing Commission. Referendum 1, legalizing pari-mutuel betting in simulcast races, passed 60% to 40% with a total of 318 votes. Referendum 2, legalizing pari-mutuel wagering on horse races, passed 60% to 40% with a total of 321 votes. The referendums received more support from Presidio area precincts and less from Marfa area precincts. Precincts 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, which cover South County, all voted a majority in favor of legalizing the betting, while precincts 1 and 7 in North County both cast a majority of their votes to reject the referendums. In Jeff Davis County, voters approved the legal sale of all alcoholic beverages, including mixed beverages, with 80% voting for and 20% against the initiative. The decision will allow for the sale of alcohol in all precincts and resolves an ongoing issue in the county by unifying all precincts under the same law. Previously, various precincts allowed the sale of alcoholic beverages and others did not, causing confusion among visiting populations and complications for business owners in the area. Brewster County voters had nothing of local interest on the ballot and only voted on the statewide constitutional amendments. All 8 statewide propositions to amend the Texas Constitution passed. Turnout was low, with only 9% of registered Texas voters casting a ballot, according to the Texas Tribune. Propositions 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, and 8 passed in Presidio County with an overwhelming majority, and Presidio and Marfa voters were aligned. Issues ranged from rodeo charity raffles to nursing home residents establishing essential caregivers for in-person visitations. Proposition 4 passed, 56% for, 44% against, but with some opposition. Presidio voters leaned against it compared to those in Marfa. The amendment would require candidates to have 10 years of experience practicing law in Texas to be eligible for election to the Texas Supreme Court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, or a Texas Court of Appeals. Currently, the law requires 10 years of experience, but allows for out-of-state experience. Statewide, voters passed the proposition 59% to 41%. Proposition 3, which would prevent the state from prohibiting or limiting religious services of religious organizations, was the only amendment that did not get approval from Presidio voters, with 47% for and 53% against. Marfa voters showed stronger opposition to the amendment than elsewhere in the county. Statewide, voters passed the proposition 62% to 38%. Marfa City Council throws weight behind new tourism app, appoints interim judge. By Sam Karras, Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. At last Thursday's regular meeting, Marfa City Council enthusiastically discussed an app presented by Director of Tourism, Abby Boyd, that could help business owners and locals address the dreaded question, what's open today? Right now, every business is acting as its own visitor center, Boyd said, outlining a common scenario. A Marfa visitor walks into the nearest business that happens to be open and asks what else there is to do in town. In the next few months, tourists may have a more streamlined way of putting together itineraries thanks to an app dreamed up by Boyd and representatives from other communities along the Texas Mountain Trail, a tourism corridor spanning the Guadalupe Mountains all the way to the Big Bend Parks. Boyd hopes to apply for Economic Development Administration, EDA, grant funding for an app that visitors to the region can pull up on their phones, pointing them to shops, restaurants, landmarks, and other points of interest, as well as extended tours based on their areas of interest. At Thursday's meeting, she demonstrated a tour hosted on the platform STQRY, which provides GPS-triggered audio and visual content as users navigate from one point of interest to the next, and tapped local IT specialist Albert Bassam for the needed programming. Through apps like STQRY, users can choose a theme, history, art, architecture, nature, to customize their experience. And the app runs off of GPS, not cell data, alleviating concerns about poor connectivity in the more remote reaches of the Big Bend. I think it's interesting from a regional perspective because the tourists in Fort Davis are not the same as the tourists in Marfa, said City Attorney Teresa Todd. But there are a few things that do transcend. The discussion raised an interesting question. Does the council need to be working to increase tourism, even as local businesses are struggling to keep up with staffing demands and residents still harbor fears about pandemic safety? I don't know that we need to boost our numbers, but this is a generous offering, said Councilmember Yosef Ben Yehuda. It could improve the quality of their experience. Maybe making them stay another night while they do a day trip down to Presidio. The council moved to work with other interested communities and apply for funding as a collective under the Rio Grande Council of Governments. The council also moved to appoint Viviana Cataño, who is currently municipal judge for the city of Presidio, as interim municipal judge for the city of Marfa. Cataño will fill the vacancy left by David Beebe, who stepped down from his position at the end of the last fiscal year. I have worked with her all the way back since 1984, said Todd. She knows this job inside and out, and she has already done all the training. Noting that many of the municipal judges' duties happen in the middle of the night, Todd explained that Cataño will mostly be working virtually until her post ends on January 11, 2022. There will be a council meeting that day, during which Bibi's permanent replacement will be selected. In miscellaneous business, the city rubber-stamped its support for Operation Lone Star, the final moving piece in securing $417,500 in funding for the Marfa Police Department through the governor's initiatives to support law enforcement in border communities. The money will go to support police overtime, salary for an administrative assistant, and costs associated with building leases and equipment. The council also received a call from Justin Teal of Lida Strategies, a political consulting firm, with updates from the third special legislative session that wrapped October 19th in Austin. In reference to the controversy over redistricting rolling in other parts of Texas, he put it simply, "No monumental changes are in store for you guys." Presidio County makes history by transferring ownership of cemetery to the Lipan Apache Tribe of Texas. By Sam Karras, Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio. In a historic vote on Monday night, Presidio City Council authorized the transfer of its lots within the Lipan Apache Cemetery to Presidio County, which had pre-authorized a donation of the land to the Lipan Apache Tribe of Texas. Over the course of 2 years, the city and county fretted over who should care for the cemetery. Its history dates back to the 18th century, when the Spanish granted reservations to the Apache near the Rio Grande as part of a peace settlement. Some Lipan fled the area. Members of the Prairie Grass Band stayed behind. They married into other families in what's now Presidio and the present-day Mexican village of El Mulato, about 20 miles downstream. This cemetery is not the only Lipan cemetery in the area. Small, privately tended cemeteries dot the landscape, from just north of Presidio and south to Redford. This is just the only one in the middle of town. It's not too far from Porter's Grocery Store and the bustling businesses on O'Reilly Street. You could miss it if you didn't know what you were looking for. A simple wire fence staked into buckets of concrete is all that marks its boundaries today, or what's left of them. Family representative Christina Hernandez explained that the cemetery used to take up the whole block before it was swallowed by the city. There are a handful of abandoned houses hugging the base of the mound, crowned by a row of simple crosses with the name Aguilar. Where the houses are, they basically razed that part of the cemetery, she said. For much of the cemetery's history, descendants of the interred have been its primary caretakers. Presidio community members have pushed back against urban encroachment for decades, but previous reporting by the Big Bend Sentinel explained that the land wound up in the hands of government entities in the 90s, complicating attempts by descendants to protect and improve the site. First on the list of improvements is a real fence to mark the space as sacred and special, off limits to errant bicyclists and dog walkers. At a commissioner's court meeting on October 13th, Family Representative Christina Hernandez and Big Bend Conservation Alliance Executive Director Shelley Bernstein explained that construction of the fence would require the services of an archaeologist and ground-penetrating radar. Their estimate came to between $40,000 and $60,000 and has since grown. "We've been told we can expect to triple that," Bernstein said on Tuesday to an audience of county officials and Lipan descendants. Presidio County's decision to authorize a land transfer back to the Lipan Apache is a groundbreaking shift in government policy toward indigenous people in the era of the Land Back movement, which aims to return indigenous land to indigenous hands. According to a 2014 figure from the Texas Politics Project, only 4,705 acres of land in the nation's second largest state has been allotted by the state for indigenous groups. In the Big Bend, the only other land owned by a tribal organization is Chillicothe Ranch outside of Valentine, a 70,000-acre property owned by the Isleta del Sur Pueblo, headquartered in El Paso. The ranch was purchased with earnings from the Pueblo's casino and is home to the tribe's herd of cattle. In other parts of the country, like the Black Hills of South Dakota, where the movement originated, land back has been marked with tense confrontations between protesters and police. That couldn't be further from the reality on the ground in Presidio, where the radical act of returning land to a tribal government was born from one family's quiet desire to take care of their own and one local government's desire not to pay for it. Enrique Madrid, a Humano activist and historian from Redford, who has worked to protect the cemetery for decades, couldn't think of a historical precedent. His wife, Ruby Madrid, has had a front row seat to his struggle to represent indigenous interests in regional conflicts, spanning the drug wars to the Trans-Pecos pipeline to the proposed border wall. Everything was taken from the natives, first the land, then the artifacts, she explained. Then the people were all but driven out of Texas. The Lipan Apache arrived in central Texas around 1600, beating the Spanish to the site of present-day San Antonio by almost 100 years. Lipan were present for the founding of a mission at Presidio. They were witness to the storming of the Alamo. Despite its important role in the Lone Star State's history, the Lipan Apache Tribe of Texas only became formally recognized by Governor Greg Abbott in 2019. Their application for federal recognition, filed in 2012, is still pending. Federally recognized tribes are regarded as having a government-to-government relationship with the United States and are eligible for certain types of funding, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Despite Texas' vast and diverse indigenous history, only three groups are recognized federally, and three are recognized by the state. Many members of the Ornelas and Aguilar families, who have been tending to the cemetery for decades, are now looking to become official members of the Lipan tribe. Tribal enrollment is not currently open to the public, but interest in formally recognizing the cemetery has also sparked many people in Presidio to formally recognize their indigenous heritage. The Lipan Apache Tribal Council has reached out to individuals of these families to personally invite them to apply for membership. What we've been told by the Lipan representatives is that we never left the tribe. We're just returning to our roots, Hernandez said. After a long process of holding family meetings to talk about the future of the site and keeping a close watch on local politics, Hernandez feels a sense of relief. Now we can move forward with the plans to preserve it, she said. The fence project has already received a pledge for $10,000 from AmeriGroup, which provides funding and health insurance services through the Presidio Clinic. We also want it to be an educational and cultural site, so we're putting a lot of thought and care on how to prevent erosion and also create an environment where people can learn more about the Lipan tribe, Hernandez explained. The Ornelas and Aguilar families, along with the Big Bend Conservation Alliance and the city of Presidio, are launching a public information campaign to try to retrieve rocks that were taken from the cemetery. As the city expanded around the site, neighbors took cairns from the mound to use in landscaping and construction projects. To the Lipan Apache, the cairns aren't just decorative rocks. They're sentinels that stand watch over the deceased. Members of the Tribal Council are planning a visit to Presidio in late November to hold a ceremony to return the cairns to their rightful place. If you know of the location of any of these rocks, you can place them along Market Street in the cemetery grounds. If you would like help transporting the rocks to the site, please text or call Elvira Hermosillo at 281-744-5254 or email ELVIRA at BigBendConservationAlliance.org. It's an honor for the city, said Mayor John Ferguson at a special ceremony held at City Hall and in the cemetery on Tuesday. Incidentally, the day many in the area celebrated Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. I'd like to congratulate the Lipan on the return of their land so it can receive the respect it deserves.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, November 4th, 2021. Gas line replacements persist, by Megan Waring. The city of Fort Stockton continues to restore cast iron gas lines around town. for a projected $438,842. The Fort Stockton City Council awarded the bid to local company Colt I&E at the October 26th regular meeting to replace the existing cast iron gas line with the necessary pipe. This includes valves, fittings, installation of tracer wire, and backfill after finishing each section. Driver Pipeline Company, Inc., a company from Irving, also submitted a bid for the same project for $2.4 million. While both companies did meet the scope of work, the City Council decided to move forward with the less expensive option. Jorge Vasquez, owner of Colt I&E, said there may be additional expenses if there are any complications during the project, but there would be communication with the City of Fort Stockton before any invoices are delivered. There are some things that happen in some jobs we do that are out of our control, Vasquez said. The city attorney will draw up an agreement between the City of Fort Stockton and Colt I&E that will go before the City Council at the next meeting, which will include the project timeline and summary costs. There are various lines in multiple locations throughout Fort Stockton that will be replaced, according to the City of Fort Stockton Public Works Director Aaron Ramos. The Fort Stockton City Council also awarded a bid for the replacement of the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system at the Convention and Visitors Bureau Event Center at their regular meeting on October 26th. For $174,846, the Bosworth Plumbing and Heating and Air Company was approved for the job. This includes replacing 12 existing rooftop units and thermostats, the necessary duct, electrical and gas connections, and removal or disposal of existing units. A specific project completion date was not decided. As of last week, Bosworth is estimating about 15 weeks out to receive equipment and build the unit, but that could change. Man charged with assaulting officers by Nathan Hewer. An execution of a failure to appear warrant led to the assault of Pecos County Sheriff's Office deputies on October 30th in Fort Stockton. A DPS CID agent spotted Justin Quintella on 5th Street on Saturday, and after identifying himself to the Fort Stockton resident, Quintella refused to cooperate, and the agent proceeded to call the Pecos County Sheriff's Office. Upon arrival, Quintella resisted arrest by Pecos County Sheriff's deputies, and he was eventually taken into custody by the Fort Stockton Police Department. A DPS agent spotted him here in town, and he called for backup. That's when deputies showed up. Deputies went hands-on with the guy because they were in uniform and DPS was not in uniform. He identified himself to him. He told him who he was. The guy didn't believe him. He kind of refused, and that's when the deputy stepped in. The Pecos County Sheriff's Office confirmed that the assault did happen to their deputies. They would not elaborate further on the matter due to an ongoing investigation. Quintella is currently being held in the county jail on bonds that total $61,000. He is being charged with failure to appear and possession of marijuana less than 2 ounces, resisting arrest, search, or transport, 2 counts of assault, peace officer, judge, and evading arrest or detention. Rachel's challenge is coming to Fort Stockton ISD. What would happen if for 1 hour the students in our schools stopped and reflected on the effects their words and actions have on their classmates? This is the question that Rachel's Challenge is asking students at thousands of schools all over America and will pose to the 3rd through 12th grade students at Fort Stockton ISD on November 9th and 10th. Parents and community members will also have an opportunity to experience the program at 7 p.m. on Wednesday night, November 10th, at the school auditorium. So, what is Rachel's challenge, and who was Rachel Joy Scott, whom the program is named in memory of? Rachel Joy Scott was the first person killed at Columbine High School. Just minutes later, her brother Craig was shot at and just escaped death in the Columbine High School library. He survived the shooting, physically unscarred that day, but witnessed the murder of his friend Isaiah Scholes standing next to him as the shooters continued their rampage through the school. Both Rachel and Craig's stories have been featured in Dateline, NBC, Fox, CNN, Oprah, Bill O'Reilly, Larry King, Hannity, and numerous other television shows. Three best-selling books have been written about Rachel and her challenge, Rachel's Tears, Chain Reaction, and Rachel Smiles. Rachel's funeral, which took place in the days after the Columbine shooting, was at the time the most watched event in the history of CNN. But she is best known for both her final words and her challenge to our nation's youth to start a chain reaction of compassion and understanding that would sweep across all our nation's schools. She was the first of two students killed at Columbine after being asked, "Are you a Christian?" answering yes. A total of 12 students and one teacher was killed by the two shooters, who later also killed themselves. Rachel was 17. Rachel's last words might make some think that Rachel's challenge is a religious one, but it is not. It is a call to our nation's youth to stand up for what's right, to act out of compassion and understanding to improve the lives of those around us, and to start a compassionate revolution, to stop violence and bullying in our schools by making people stop and think about how their words and actions affect others. She believed that if each person, by reaching out to others in compassion and kindness, a powerful chain reaction of goodness would be started that could change the world one person at a time. As she wrote, "People will never know how far a little kindness can go." Rachel's challenge started as a classroom assignment for a fifth-period junior language arts teacher at Columbine High School. Students were to lay out their personal philosophies of life in an essay or video presentation. Rachel Scott explained in her video that she wanted to be the start of a chain reaction of compassion that could sweep the nation, improving the lives of everyone. She explained in her own way that by acting to improve the lives of other people with random acts of kindness and compassion, and then those people each doing random acts of compassion for others, soon a chain reaction of compassion would sweep across the nation's and its school. The speakers of Rachel's Challenge are dedicated to seeing that Rachel's chain reaction goes further and touches more people's lives than that of the young men that killed her only a few short weeks after the assignments were submitted. Rachel's Challenge has been honored by Presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump for their work. FSISD presenter will be Cody Hodges, the former quarterback of Texas Tech. Cody graduated from Tech. He was drafted by the NFL's Tennessee Titans and now speaks regularly for Rachel's Challenge. Students Learn Seatbelt Safety by Jeremy Gonzalez. The Texas Department of Transportation and the City of Fort Stockton Municipal Court joined forces this week to give seatbelt safety presentations at elementary school campuses. The presentations took place at Alamo and Apache schools with a booster seat giveaway. The raffled booster seats were generously donated by the local Walmart. TxDOT traffic safety specialist Gina Galindo showed students how to correctly wear a seatbelt, measured volunteers to booster seat height requirements, spoke on the dangers of front seat airbags, and reminded students to always look both ways for traffic. City of Fort Stockton Municipal Court Judge Maribel Perkins also spoke during the presentations to explain the consequences of breaking traffic safety rules. Using right and wrong principles, Perkins taught students to appreciate law enforcement officers and simplified how laws are set to protect community. School Resource Officer Rosalie Acosta was presented at the Alamo presentations to greet the students and affirm that police officers are on duty to ensure the safety of all citizens. Perkins and her court clerk, Marissa Martinez, provided students with traffic safety activity coloring books to further the education provided in the presentations.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 28th. 2021 MHS grad dies in crash. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans community and school district are mourning the loss of a 2021 high school graduate who died in a car crash last Saturday, October 23rd. Latricia Araceli Powers, age 18, a 2021 graduate of Monahans High School, has died as a result of the crash she was involved in Saturday evening around 8 p.m. near Tarzan. According to Texas Department of Public Safety Officer Oscar Villarreal, quote, Powers was driving a 2012 Mazda passenger car west on State Highway 176, 1 mile east of Tarzan, while Zachary L. Johnson, age 39, of Toller, was traveling east on State Highway 176 in a 2013 Ford F-350. Powers made an unsafe turn and collided with Johnson, end quote. Powers was not wearing a seatbelt and was pronounced dead at the scene by Justice of the Peace Gerald Hedrick. Johnson and his passenger, Douglas K. Baker, age 46, of Granbury, were not injured. Weather conditions were clear and dry at the time of the accident. Trooper Preston Hageman of Big Spring investigated the crash. Powers was active in swimming, track, and powerlifting while a student at Monahans High School and was attending Midland College to continue her education and complete her nursing degree. She is the daughter of Talia Plylar of Houston and Travis and Tanya Powers of Monahans. A GoFundMe has been set up on behalf of Latresa to help offset funeral costs. Architect hired for Event Center Park. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Ward County Commissioners agreed to a contract with KDC Associates for design and construction of an Event Center Park during their regular meeting on Monday morning. A budget amount of $2 million has been set aside for design and construction of the park, which will be a four-acre park north of the Event Center. Some of the things to be considered include playground equipment, a water feature, low-maintenance landscaping, paved walking paths, underground irrigation, and more. Kelly Cook of KDC Associates described the design proposal. Cook said, quote, A four-acre park typically costs about $1 million per acre. Quite honestly, $2 million might be a bit low, especially with the water feature, end quote. County Judge Greg Holly said, quote, Nothing is set in stone, and we will have a committee to work with you to come up with recommendations. But ultimately, final decisions will be made by the court, end quote. The committee to meet with KDC Associates will be Holly, County Auditor Ellen Fryer, Commissioner Larry Hanna, and County Construction Superintendent Bill Dean. The proposal presented by Cook is $1.8 million for park construction and $166,000 in architectural fees. Target completion date for the park is by the end of 2022, Cook said. Although no action was taken, commissioners held a lengthy discussion regarding an unsatisfactory software performance of Golagic for records management and jail system management systems for the Ward County Sheriff's Office. A proposal from an alternative vendor, Computer Information Systems Incorporated, was discussed, but action was tabled to allow Sheriff Frerin Valle time to seek references on the performance of CIS with other area sheriffs that use their software. Chief Deputy Michael Franco said that issues with Colagic had caused delays in implementation, quote, and things are still not working correctly. Colagic has been working on the software since the end of 2020. In some cases, a modification to the software actually made things worse. It has been a struggle, Franco said. The agreement was to include equipment software and licenses to consolidate the operations of the Sheriff's Department, including jail reports, call reports, CopSync, and new modules to support infectious disease and social distancing. Colagic has agreed to refund half of the $65,000 already paid to the county. the remaining $75,000 will not be paid. The proposal from CIS includes the same functionality as that of Kolajic at a cost of $177,000, with $75,000 payable on the first year, $102,000 payable on the second year, and maintenance and support costs of $16,000 per year after the first year. Before taking any final action, commissioners agreed with Valier to seek further information and recommendations from other users of the CIS system. Consideration will be placed on the agenda for the November 8th commissioners' meeting. Commissioners present for the meeting were Larry Hanna, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Nelms. Commissioner Tino Sanchez was not present. In other action, repairs to the pro shop roof at the Ward County Golf Course was approved. The proposal from Protex Roofing Incorporated of Carrollton, Texas, in the amount of $39,000 was accepted. Accounts payable totaling $1.7 million was approved. Commissioners will hold a special meeting on November 3rd at 9 a.m. to discuss potential redistricting of precinct boundaries. The next regular session will be held on November 8th at 9:30 a.m. Both meetings will be held at the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. West 5th Street property deemed dangerous. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Meeting for the final time in October, the Monahan City Council met for a relatively short agenda, and after establishing a quorum and approving previous minutes and financials, the board considered agenda items such as increasing the preceding budget, acting on properties in violation of city code, and returning unused FAA funds to TxDOT Aviation. In first readings, the council approved Ordinance 1295, which will amend the preceding budget and increase the budget by $226,000. The city received grant funding from the CARES, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which will reimburse the city for law enforcement payroll for the months of August, September, and October of 2020. Quote, "This funding is able to be used to cover police salaries because first responders' actions during the pandemic went above and beyond the normal realm of their duties," City Manager Rex Thee said. The amendment will increase last year's general fund budget line item, Police Personnel Operations, by $226,000, from $1.3 million to $1.5 million. In regular business, the council took note of a lengthy list of properties submitted by Code Enforcement Officer Richard Covington, found to be in violation of Section 13-2 and or 6-31 of the City Code of Ordinances, which is defined as cleanliness of premises and dangerous structures, respectively. Violators have 10 days from the date of the notice to get the property cleaned and up to code. Quote, "Some of these people have had 2 to 3 weeks to clean up their property. Whether it is due to the timing of the city council meeting or because the owner asked for an extension," Covington said. Properties currently shown to be in violation are 1500 South Kenneth Street, owned by Easton Haslam, 708 South Eric, owned by Kathy Human, 314 West 5th Street, owned by D.G. Smith, 1112 South Alice Street, owned by Felipe Arroyo, 901 North Carroll Street, owned by John Moya, 109 West 2nd Street, owned by Dr. J.J. Coates, 403 North Bruce, owned by Salima Acosta, 803 South Kenneth Street, owned by Jason Molinar, 518 West 14th Street, owned by Anthony Vasquez, 304 West 3rd Street, owned by Arnulfo Salceda, 410 East Sealy, owned by Paul Jordan, 400 West 4th Street, owned by Arnolfo Salcida, 404 West 4th Street, owned by Henry Gruppe, 406 West 4th Street, owned by Paula Nahar, 506 West 4th Street, owned by Andrew Anderson, 507 West 5th Street, owned by Mary Navarrete, and 511 West 5th Street, owned by Norma Caldwell. Since the council took note of these properties, a second notice of city ordinance violation will be sent via certified mail, and the owner will have another 10 days to comply before the case is sent to municipal court. City Manager Rex Thee told the council 708 South Kenneth was set to go up for sale for taxes. Quote, "We'll hold off on sending a second notice, and hopefully the new owner will clean up the property," he said. Thee also noted 314 West 5th Street was, quote, "dangerous and is on the city's radar to be torn down at some point if the owner did not comply and get the area cleaned up," end quote. Municipal Court Judge Lori Asbury was on hand for the meeting, and Councilmember Calvin Carroll asked her if the disposition of the cases, which are turned over to the municipal court for noncompliance, could be included in the monthly reports submitted to the council for approval. Asbury told the council she would include that in the report. Along with Thee and Carroll, present were council members Jeppy Wilson, Richard Hawkins, Ivy Valenzuela, as well as Mayor Alan Steen and City Attorney Alan Nicholas. Member Rudy Hernandez was absent. In other business, council members approved transferring $150,000 of unused 2017 FAA non-primary funds to TxDOT Aviation. Thee said, quote, "By transferring the unused funds, it will be earmarked by TxDOT Aviation for our use only in the future once the account has enough funds to do so," end quote. Thee added, quote, "The city has submitted a letter of intent or a wish list, which includes repairing the short runway the same way the larger one was repaired," end quote. The council convened an executive session to consider approving the resignations of appointed board member Renee Heflin of the Monahans Economic Development Board and to the appointment of one member. After reconvening into regular session, Thee said, quote, "The council accepted Renee Heflin's resignation, and Leticia Rodriguez has been appointed to the board for a 3-year term," end quote. The appointment is subject to Rodriguez's acceptance of the position. The next city council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, November 9th, in the council chambers at City Hall at 112 West 2nd Street. PT Clinic passes inspection, opening still delayed. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Opening of the renovated physical therapy clinic of Ward Memorial Hospital continues to be delayed. Quote, "Everything has been completed except a fiber optic connection to enable internet services has still not been completed. It will probably be another week," hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez told the managers in last Thursday's meeting. The clinic passed final building inspection with the exception of two minor issues that will not affect the opening. Incorrect handicap parking signage and an issue with grab bar spacing were noted on the inspection report. Neither item affects the clinic passing inspection, and both issues are expected to be remedied in a few days. In presenting the financial reports, Rodriguez said there are still numerous issues with the new accounting software from CPSI. Quote, "We are a beta site for this new software, but the issues are frustrating and requiring a lot of extra work on data entry and payment of bills. One of their engineers will be on site next week to help us get some of these issues resolved," Rodriguez said. However, Rodriguez was able to present an overview of the financials. Revenue from hospital operations is $10.2 million and total revenue of $13.9 million. Expenses are $18 million for a deficit of $4 million. The 340B drug program is down by $1.2 million and supplies are $2.5 million, mostly for COVID expenses, and $2 million for the PT renovation. Quote, "We are able to do a lot more with less compared to other area hospitals," Rodriguez said. Managers present for the meeting were Dr. John Fawcett, Lisa Stewart, Gerald Carlson, Angel Fuentes, Tommy Escamilla, and Jeff Burdick. Managers Frank Heslin and Larry Hunt were not present. Payment of bills totaling $868,000 was approved. Meeting with architects was scheduled for this week to begin work on a master plan for hospital renovation. The first action will be upgrading patient rooms to be ADA compliant and to eliminate shared bathrooms. Ward County Commissioners had approved the plan to modernize the hospital in lieu of building a new hospital. In routine matters, minutes of the October 7th meeting were approved. The next meeting of the managers will be held on November 4th at 6:15 p.m. in the Physical Therapy Building at 420 South Ike Street. Vargas facing sexual assault charge. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man was arrested on a charge of alleged sexual assault of a friend after a night of drinking. Javier Jesus Vargas, age 20, of 204 West 14th Street of Monahans, was arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail on October 21st on an arrest warrant, charging him with sexual assault, a second-degree felony. Quote, "On September 26, around 5:42 a.m., Lieutenant Jeremy Kynes responded to 601 South Franklin to assist Sergeant Esquivel Ramon on a possible sexual assault of a 20-year-old female," Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana said. After speaking to the victim, officers learned that Vargas and the victim were friends and had been out drinking. Upon returning to the residence on Franklin, the victim said Vargas sexually assaulted her, Quintana added. Lieutenant Jeremy Kynes made contact with Vargas, who immediately requested a lawyer and did not wish to speak to officers. Based on evidence and victim statements, officers had enough probable cause and were able to obtain an arrest warrant for Vargas on October 21st, and he was subsequently arrested. Vargas posted bond of $25,000 and was released. If convicted, Vargas could face between 2 and 20 years imprisonment and or a fine of up to $10,000.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.